This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. We'll visit today with the artistic director of the Clarion Society of New York, an orchestra and chorus with a distinguished history. That's them singing the Amen from Luigi Cherubini's Missa Solemnis, recorded back in 1971. Clarion was founded in 1957 by Newell Jenkins, making it one of the oldest and most highly regarded period instrument orchestras in America. Many works found new life with this organization. After Mr. Jenkins passed, the Clarion went away, but it wasn't an amen on the group, as in 2006 it was revived under my guest's direction, Artistic Director of Clarion Society, Stephen Fox. Mr. Fox has been immersed in the voice and choral music his whole life. He was Associate Conductor at the New York City Opera, Assistant Conductor for the Metropolitan Opera's Lindemann Young Artists Program, and Juilliard Opera. He is also Artistic Director and Principal Conductor of New Jersey's Pro Arte Chorale. In his college days, his interests led him to early music performance mixed with an intense love of all things Russian. Being able to go over to St. Petersburg allowed him to form that country's first period instrument orchestra, Musica Antiqua St. Petersburg. Upon taking over the new Clarion Society, he shifted equal focus on orchestra and chorus. He has led them to great acclaim, most recently with a recording of a major piece of Russian choral music by the prize pupil of Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, who then turned around to teach such composers as Dmitri Shostakovich. Maximilian Steinberg. Steinberg is spelled like Steinberg, and though he was the prize pupil of Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, he also married Rimsky-Korsakov's daughter. The work is called Passion Week, composed in 1923, and though it draws some inspiration from a similar work by Alexander Gretchaninov, this work stands out on its own as a discovered masterpiece. It is drawing wide interest and praise, and my guest and his choir have introduced it to a new audience here in the U.S. and given it a welcome return back in its home country of Russia. In fact, they are in Russia as we broadcast this, performing it in Moscow. We'll hear excerpts from this recording on the Naxos label throughout the program. I caught up with Maestro Fox in New York City a few weeks back. So Maestro Stephen Fox, right? So the Clarion Choir, the Clarion Orchestra, come by a very interesting confluence of strengths, being early music and Russian music. I know there's other things, but strengths. And that seems all to be due to you. I wonder if we, just to start off, give our audience some background, as they may not know your work or anything, too. Your background, first about your choral background, and then your interest in early music, but then the Russian side. I know you've done other things. You worked with New York City Opera, and you worked with the Lindemann Program at the Met, so that's good grounding. But just how you got into the choral vocal field, and then those two areas, and especially your experience in Russia, breaking ground with early music, so mixing the two. So there you go.
Well, first of all, thank you for calling me Maestro.
You're welcome.
Any conductor who says they don't like being called Maestro is lying.
It's true.
So, thank you. But it's true. I think that the Clarion Board, when they brought me in to revive their concert series in 2006, I feel very lucky that they've let the repertoire of the group kind of take the shape of my particular interests. Of course, Clarion did have a very specific mission from way back in the 50s when it was founded by Newell Jenkins to perform early music, and in particular music that is not particularly well known. And Jenkins himself was as much a musicologist as he was a conductor.
Right.
And every summer he would go and scour the Italian archives and come back with things that he's found and premiere them in New York. These were pieces by Sammartini and Vivaldi, back in the time when Vivaldi was not actually a household name. And we think that Jenkins had a lot to do with making Vivaldi a household name, which is why in the past few years we've given some concerts that have really been dedicated to his work, performing Sammartini and Vivaldi. But regarding my own particular interests, even as they were developed before I started with Clarion, I was always a singer. I mean, choral music is really my first love. I sang in choirs from the time that I grew up here in New York as a boy, and then continued in high school. And that repertoire is perhaps the closest to my heart of all. Since then, I've developed other interests, of course, interesting orchestral repertoire, opera, and choral orchestral repertoire. Mm-hmm. But in a way, choral music is my first love. And that's why when I began working with Clarion, the focus under Jenkins' leadership and also his successor, who was Frederick Hammond, I'm the third director, the mission was really centered on the orchestra, that it was one of the first period instrument orchestras to have a concert series here in North America. And the concert series was very much built around the orchestra. And I felt it was important to honor that, but I also, given my penchant for choral music, decided to try to build the profile of the Clarion Choir. And at first, the choir would perform only together with the orchestra, but then, several years later, it really began with invitations from other presenters. The choir was invited to perform separately, sometimes a cappella works. So this worked well, and we eventually branched out to the point where I think that the orchestra and the choir had their own profile very much. And they perform together, but they also perform separately. And regarding my interest in Russian music, that actually began with a love of the Russian language. I grew up here in New York, and I went to Horace Mann, which is in the Bronx, both through elementary and high school. And in high school, they actually offered Russian as a language. They don't anymore, sadly, but I don't think there were too many high schools that offered Russian.
No.
But I was pretty lucky that Horace Mann did offer it. And I was studying French, I remember, in the ninth grade. And I was walking down the corridor, and I heard this conversation taking place between two gentlemen. And I just thought it was the most beautiful language they were speaking. These dark sounds, just a very poetic kind of sound. And I had to ask them, I said, where are you from? And they both said, oh, we're from Moscow. And one of them said, I'm the one that teaches Russian here. And I immediately switched in. And so I ended up studying Russian in high school for 3 years. And then when I got to college, I thought for a while about maybe studying another language, but they say once you're bitten by the bug, with Russian, anything Russian, Russian culture, Russian music, that it never goes away. Mm. And so suddenly I found myself again in Russian classes at Dartmouth College, which is where I did my undergraduate degree. And then I signed up for the exchange term, the foreign study program that Dartmouth hosted each year in St. Petersburg. And so I went for 3 months just to study the language at the Smolny Institute in St. Petersburg. And this was 1998. I remember the ruble had just been devalued, and it was a difficult time for the Russians economically. For us, it was, in a way, it made our meager student budgets go so far. And, we were able to go to the opera and the ballet every night. I remember getting orchestra seats at the Mariinsky Theater for $2.
Right.
And I just fell in love with that city and everything about it. Not only the language, but the music, the history, the culture. And when it was time to leave, I just vowed that I wanted to go back there. I wanted to find my way back to St. Petersburg. And at Dartmouth, I had gotten more into conducting, and I had started my own group. And my senior year, inspired by the experiences that I had in St. Petersburg that year, I decided to put on a Russian concert series. It was part of my senior fellowship project. So I did one choral and one opera project. And the choral project was Rachmaninoff Vespers. It was a piece that I didn't know at the time, but I called my teacher, Johannes Samari, back in New York, and I said, what's a great Russian choral work that I can do? And he didn't even have to think about it. He said, Rachmaninoff Vespers, this is a great piece. It's going to have great impact, and it'd be a good project for you. And so I remember putting together about 28 Dartmouth students, and then I was able to get another special grant to bring in 12 professional singers from the area, but also from New York, that came up, and they enhanced the choir, because it's quite a difficult piece to sing. And so it was about 40 of us, and that was the first time I conducted that piece. I'm lucky that I've had the chance to do it since then. I feel like I've grown with it, but that was a really important experience for me, and just something that really ignited this passion for Russian music, and in particular Russian choral music. The second concert that I did was excerpts of Russian opera and ballet, things that I saw when I was in St. Petersburg, that I remembered from the Mariinsky Theater and the Mussorgsky Theater there. I remember we did parts of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty. We did a big segment from Boris Godunov, and that was by far the hardest thing I had conducted to that point, technically. Really challenged me. We did one of Glinka's overtures to A Life for the Tsar. That concert just reaffirmed this love affair with Russian music. And that was something that I took into my professional life. At the end of that year, still wanting to go back to St. Petersburg, I applied for a grant from Dartmouth. It's called the Reynolds Grant. It has the same form as modeled on the Fulbright Scholarship. So it supports a recent graduate in any kind of international project that they devise, as long as it's, you know, sounds reasonable and approved. But, you know, my project, I don't know how it got approved because it didn't sound reasonable at all. I proposed that I was going to go back to St. Petersburg, and having seen mostly concerts of 19th and 20th century music when I was in St. Petersburg, I do recall that the few concerts that I saw of 18th century music were not as strong, that they were performed in ways that we might consider now to be old-fashioned, a little bit overly romanticized, very heavy, and kind of what I would think of as a 1950s style here. But there was an exception. The last night I was in St. Petersburg as an exchange student, I went to see a concert in the small hall of the Philharmonic, and it was a group of Baroque specialists from the Moscow Conservatory. They were led by their professor at the violin, and then they were undergraduate and master's students in the Moscow Conservatory, about 10 of them. And they played actual 18th century arrangements of Mozart and Rossini overtures, 18th and early 19th century arrangements. So contemporary arrangements of these pieces that were written so that people could play this operatic music in their own homes. And the playing was so outstanding. I just thought that they had such great energy, such beautiful phrasing, and the style was totally convincing. And I thought perhaps they were playing on period instruments. It was hard to tell. And eventually I realized that they were playing, you know, the string players were using period bows and gut strings, but that the instruments themselves were more modern. They still had the elongated necks and things that modern string instruments have. And same thing with the wind instruments. They were making compromises in that regard, but it didn't matter. I mean, their style was so convincing and so wonderful to listen to. And so I was inspired to go backstage. And I remember asking him, I said, are there groups like yours playing on period instruments or playing in a historically informed way as you do? And he said, there are few other ensembles like ours in St. Petersburg and Moscow. I said, well, is there a period instrument orchestra? And he said, no, there's not. There have been a couple of attempts to start one, but none of them has been successful. And so when I was applying for this Reynolds grant, I thought maybe I could go back there and I could put together the musicians from these different ensembles and try to make a period orchestra and Russia's first period orchestra. Mm-hmm. So I remember proposing this to the grant committee and they really looked at me like I was insane. But luckily, a couple of them had attended some of my concerts, actually those Russian concerts on campus, which were quite ambitious. They were big concerts, I guess, for a student to put on. And I think that they made an argument for me. They said, you know what? He has done some successful concerts on campus here. Let's give him a shot and see what he does. And so, lucky enough, they did give me a grant. It supported my going over there for a year. And actually helped pay for the first couple of concerts that I would give with this orchestra, which I ended up spending about 3 months putting together. And I called them Musica Antiqua St. Petersburg. Mm-hmm. It was through them that I actually eventually came in contact with Clarion, because I took the group on tour twice to the United States. And with Musica Antiqua, we played a lot of classical repertoire, and well-known classical repertoire. We do a lot of Mozart and Haydn, some Beethoven. But then we also did much lesser-known classical repertoire, and what I would consider to be Russian early music, which is repertoire that's still really unknown. Mm-hmm. Composers such as Bortnyansky, Fomin, Berezovsky. Mm-hmm. These composers were contemporaries of Mozart and Haydn, but their music was never published as much, and they're just not as well known. Mm-hmm. So with Musica Antiqua, we developed a kind of pattern where we would pair some well-known 18th century music with much lesser-known Russian 18th century music. And this is why we got asked twice to do a couple of concerts here in New York, particularly for the Russian repertoire, which was so unknown. And obviously, it's expensive to bring a group overseas, so we had to work hard on the fundraising, and we were close, I remember, for that second tour, but we were still short on the funds for our flights. So I remember meeting with someone from the friends of the Hermitage Museum here in New York. And I thought maybe she could help or knew of a foundation that could. And I told her about this project and she said, you know, there's an organization that I've been on the board of for a long time. It used to have this venerable concert series here in New York, but since the founder passed away, it's sort of gone defunct. But the foundation still exists. It's called Clarion Music Society. And she said, you should apply to them for this. And I did, and Clarion gave us a grant that helped us come over. And so when the orchestra did come over and we gave this concert, you know, half of which was completely unknown Russian 18th century music, the Clarion board really loved it, and they were in a way reminded of Newell Jenkins' work in Italian 18th century music.
Right.
And a couple of months later, I got a call from the president of the board, Andrea Pampanini, and he said, you know, we've been looking for someone to help us revive our concert series since Newell Jenkins passed away, and we'd like to make the offer to you. I was still living in St. Petersburg at the time, but I was missing New York. I thought, man, it'd be nice to find a way to get back involved in New York's music scene, and I thought this was a great opportunity to do so. So that's actually how I became involved with Clarion.
That's a great story of the Tale of Two Cities, of St. Petersburg and New York. It's really great. When you then came back, does the group still exist in St. Petersburg? Or?
We kept operating as a regular group for about 4 years.
Yeah.
And at this point, the group operates on projects. So we do reassemble. It's not a full-time orchestra or anything like that. But, you know, my friends are still there, and they work with different ensembles and are very busy. Many of them play with some of the European period orchestras as well. So for special projects, like several years ago, we did a Russian opera by Bortnyansky.
Mm.
In the Hermitage Theater, so we reassembled for that big project, and it's the kind of thing I'd like to do again, actually.
The audiences over there were appreciative of hearing this?
They were very appreciative.
Early in there?
Yes, they were very appreciative. They were a little bit incredulous at first that there could be great Russian music from before Glinka's time.
Right.
You know, I mean, the history books say, I remember reading some old history books, both in the Russian and in the English language, that start off, there was a little bit of Russian music in the 18th century, but Russian music truly begins in all of its glory with the birth of Glinka in, I think it's 1804. And really, historians have just not given much attention to 18th century Russian music. And I think perhaps it's because it's not so distinctive in terms of the Russian characteristics. It's more European. But to me, it still does have intrinsic, very Russian characteristics. But more importantly, the quality of the music is, in so many of these cases, so high that it really deserves to be heard.
Were they cool with an American leading the group?
I always found that I was very warmly greeted there. You know, it started off when I was a student in 98. I thought people were fascinated to meet an American at that time. And then, yes, I always felt very warmly welcomed, particularly in the musical community. You know, even at times when I wasn't necessarily expecting to be well-received, that I always find the Russians to be extremely warm people. They have such a deep, deep connection with their own musical legacy that it's a real connection, the music.
Here are the opening two movements from Maximilian Steinberg's Passion Week, composed in 1923, Alleluia and Behold the Bridegroom Comes, from the Naxos recording of the work by the Clarion Choir, led by their artistic director and my guest today, Stephen Fox.
Thank you.
recordings, two things. First of all, you mentioned Newell Jenkins. There actually still is one recording out on the market of him conducting Clarion. It's on the old Vanguard Pressing Everyman label, the Cherubini Mass.
Right.
It's still available on CD. I don't know how you can find it or where you can find it, but it's still out there. Your new recording on the Naxos label. First time Clarion's on the Naxos label, right?
Yes.
Yeah. It's a Russian composer. Not surprising after what we've been talking about. But it's a name that most of our listeners won't know. And just by his name, doesn't sound Russian. Well, I'll let you say not only who he is, but talk about his life connections, his teachers, his pupils, because it's amazing this guy sort of slipped through the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
So go ahead. This is Maximilian Steinberg. Steinberg.
Yeah, Steinberg.
Does he go by the German?
In Russian, you'd say Steinberg.
Steinberg. Spelled Steinberg.
Spelled as Steinberg, exactly. Yeah. I find that I'm using both interchangeably.
Yeah.
So, very fascinating, brilliant composer that I too was really grateful to learn about through this process. And he was a composer that grew up in St. Petersburg and became a major figure in St. Petersburg. He was really the prized student, the most prized student of Rimsky-Korsakov. And Rimsky took him on trips to Paris, for instance, to see the Ballet Russe there, and really sort of groomed him to be his successor, which he did become. He took Rimsky's teaching position at St. Petersburg Conservatory, and he later became vice-rector of the St. Petersburg Conservatory. He was Shostakovich's main teacher, and that actually plays in very importantly to this story of how Passion Week actually came to light. But he was also, just to mention, a classmate of Stravinsky's.
Yeah.
So you see, he was, you know, part of this great succession of wonderful Russian composers. And he was, of course, a big player in St. Petersburg at this great time when it was a melting pot of these great musicians, great performers, and composers working together in that great city.
Continuing to sample from the Naxos recording of Maximilian Steinberg's Passion Week, performed by my guest today, Stephen Fox, leading his clarion choir, here is the movement about the man who gave his grave for the body of the crucified Christ, the noble Joseph.
Thank you.
This piece was brought to my attention by my colleague Barbara Mauck when I first met her. And Barbara and I started working together first with Musica Antiqua St. Petersburg. She and I met in New York, but she has this Russian connection. Her father, a Russian-American conductor, was born in the United States. And she had a very deep connection with Russian music and Russian culture. So when she and I met in New York, we really hit it off. And we decided to start working together in regards to my Russian group. She came over to St. Petersburg a couple of times and helped me produce a couple of projects with them. And then when things took off with Clarion, as I was talking about earlier, I did suggest to them that we also take on Barbara as an administrative director. And so Barbara started with Clarion very shortly after I did. And one of the first things that she brought to my attention was this piece called Passion Week.
Before we get to the piece, we should back up and say Steinberg isn't a one-piece composer. He wrote a lot of music.
Yes.
And he wrote symphonies and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, it's very odd that we're going to talk about this piece.
Yeah.
But that all of that would go into a black hole, basically. I mean, there's very little recorded documentation of many of the works at all.
Yes. I do find that his instrumental works are much better known in Russia.
But I mean, but internationally,
internationally, they're really not. And chorally, this piece is really one of its kind. We can't seem to find any other major choral works that he wrote, which seems strange because this writing in Passion Week is the writing of someone who really understands choral music and how to write for voices.
Definitely.
It seems like an experienced hand.
And even takes risks chorally, which means you have to be very confident in what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. He does take a lot of risk. I think you're right. Harmonically, there are a lot of surprises in this piece, particularly for its time.
Yeah.
It takes unexpected turns. And vocally, it also weaves in and out of unison and silence. It makes a great use of silence, the breaths that take place in between phrases, and I think that comes out of the plain chant upon which the piece is based. Each of the movements is based upon an ancient plain chant that comes from Holy Week, and I think that he really honored that style. First of all, he leaves those plain chant melodies unaltered in the piece, but also when you sing plain chant, you know, you notice when everyone breathes together in between phrases. And he's really kept that aspect alive, even though the piece is set in a much more complex way with many different parts and polyphony. He has maintained these moments where everyone breathes together. I think it's very powerful. It adds an aspect of contemplativeness to the piece. Oftentimes, it's a very, very rich harmonic texture that out of nowhere will suddenly blend into a single voice. I find these moments can be very haunting, and in a way they're reflective of their time. You know, we're coming out of Romanticism and entering into this period where this music has just been banned. And I wonder if those moments are connected with the feeling of fear that artists had at that time.
Yeah, the banning is because of the Bolshevik Revolution.
That's right.
Steinberg stayed very conservative in his, despite being Shostakovich, he also taught Uspaskaya, right? And Galina Uspaskaya, I believe. So though even that next generation he had a hand in. But, I mean, I can think of Russian pieces having to do with Easter. I don't know if I can think of another piece having really to be caught up with the Passion story.
Yeah.
This is also an oddity.
Yeah, there's a similar work that he probably did know by Gretchaninoff.
Okay.
That sets similar texts. So it seems to me that he may have been working off of that as a model, possibly.
Right.
And that, by the way, also is a piece I think should be better known.
But there's
maybe that's our next project. But
Passion Week, there's no cousining with the Bach Passions or anything like this. This is a real Russian Orthodox vein that has come back.
Yes, it does seem like a very different kind of thing from a setting of a Passion by Bach or Schütz. And first of all, there's no evangelist voice running through it per se. It's more of a conglomeration of different texts, some of which are scriptural, but some of which are sort of hymns and commentary on what's happening. And he does organize them in a way that sort of moves logically through the different days of Holy Week, but you're getting views from all different angles for each movement.
Do Russians, not your everyday Russian, but I mean a Russian who's cultured into the music of their country, do they know this piece?
No.
Okay.
They don't. And that's why after we gave the New York premiere in 2014, I just had the idea, I thought, it's still never been done in Russia. So I had the idea, but I didn't act on it until a couple of months later when I was approached at a dinner party by someone who was at the concert and recognized me. Her name was Tanya Rodzianko, and she was from the Department of State. I had no idea that anyone from the Department of State was at the concert. I think it was just she had heard about it, and she's Russian herself, right, of Russian background, and she loves Russian music. She sings this kind of music in a Russian Orthodox church every Sunday, and she came to me and said that she just felt the piece was extraordinary and couldn't believe how beautiful it was. And I thought, when she mentioned she was from the State Department, I said, well, you know, the piece has still never been done in Russia, and I was thinking about a way we might be able to take it over there and perform it for the first time, and how significant it might be for an American group to do that as a gesture. You know, it was an American family that were the custodians of this piece for a long time, and it could be a gesture of goodwill and just deep appreciation of Russian music and culture to return it there. And she just loved the idea so much that 2 weeks later or so, we were hearing from the U.S. Embassy in Moscow about how we can come over there.
So it's twice in your life you were taking Russian music that Russians didn't know back to Russia, in a sense.
I guess I'm doing that again.
Once again, from Passion Week by Maximilian Steinberg, the Clarion Choir, led by my guest today, and their artistic director, Stephen Fox, will hear the movement's Do Not Lament Me, O Mother.
if people love the sound of Russian choral music, and many people do, it's just it's an all-enveloping vocal sound, which is really unlike a lot of that Slavic sound, whether it's the range and the basses and all the rest of it. And they're looking for a choral piece, maybe a choral conductor's looking for a piece. Usually the top drawer piece they turn to is the Rachmaninoff Vespers.
Yeah.
Maybe they do the Liturgy of St. John, you know, by Rachmaninoff. But there isn't a lot there, you know. And this piece should, having heard it, it should rank right up there with them. It should be that well known for what it is.
Yeah, I really believe it should, too. And I think that there are others, too. And if anything, this has given us the impetus to dig deeper. This is why I really admire the work of Vladimir Marozan, who runs Musica Rusica in San Diego, which is a publishing company that focuses pretty much entirely on, as far as I understand, almost entirely on Russian sacred music, Russian choral music. You know, it's his mission to make so many of the other great pieces of Russian choral literature known. And so, you know, we have a nice collaboration with him. We're always talking with him about new repertoire and other pieces that we might do, and he has a great wealth of knowledge. He was instrumental in making a new edition of this piece. When we sang the open reading of this piece, before the piece had ever been heard anywhere, I just wanted to know what it sounded like.
Right.
So in April of 2014, this is well before we gave the formal premiere, I just got the group together and I said, let's just do an open reading. Let's read through this piece and hear what it sounded like. And in this case, we were reading from these old copies that were given to me by Barbara, whom I was mentioning, because Barbara believes that her father was given the score by Shostakovich on
wow.
one of his trips, because Shostakovich knew that the piece never had a chance of being performed in Soviet Russia.
Right.
So given his international status and all the traveling he did, you know, he had the chance to take this score by his teacher. And he was known to be a champion of his teacher's works, not only this one, but others.
Mm-hmm.
And gave it to Barbara's father, because Barbara's father, Igor Bukerov, was a very fine conductor. And he was also a champion of new music and of music that was not well known, that deserved to be known. And he had his own organization that was a great source of promotion for contemporary composers that he really admired. But this was one of the pieces that he felt was so important. And Barbara told me that he used to talk about it all through her childhood, this piece. And then he really tried to find an American choir to do it in his lifetime. He showed it to a few American choirs, but they were, I guess, intimidated by the Church Slavonic, which obviously is very challenging. It's the old form of Russian. It's the ancestor of all the Slavic languages. And it's the language of the Russian Orthodox Church, sort of how Latin is to all of the Romance languages. And between the Church Slavonic and the very, very long lines, which actually are difficult to sing, the choirs he showed it to shied away from it. So he eventually handed the project off to Barbara, and he said, you've got to find a choir to do this. And that's why she kept mentioning it to me. And when she first mentioned it to me, Clarion was so completely focused on early music
right.
that I thought, I'll have a look at it, but I don't think it's really something we can do. But then when our choir developed its own profile and started doing different things, I remember we were invited to do this Morton Feldman piece at Lincoln Center. And I said, well, it's not really our thing, but well, we should do it. And we enjoyed it so much, and the choir loved it, and they were so good at it. I think that just the training of doing early music and the discipline that we built in on doing Bach and Handel and Mozart really helped us with modern music. And then we were invited a couple of years later to do a Russian program at Trinity Wall Street as part of their 12th Night Festival. And then we were invited to do Rachmaninoff Vespers at the next 12th Night Festival and also at a festival in Quebec. And this is when Barbara reapproached me and she said, okay, if you're doing Rachmaninoff Vespers, you have no excuse. You've got to look
right.
at this piece. And that's when I did sit down with it and I realized this is an extraordinary work. It's really an important piece.
Yeah.
I think it
she found her choir.
Comes out of the, yeah. And it comes out of Rachmaninoff's style. You can hear that. It
yeah.
does have the lush romanticism and that palette. But then I think it also, it takes a little more risk harmonically than Rachmaninoff often does. And it's a slightly more modern palette. And then, as I was describing before, it has these moments of eeriness as well that you don't find in Rachmaninoff's works. And that's where I think it just shows that it's a little bit more modern.
Well, I think this recording will get a buzz. It'll get good reviews or anything. And then I'm just curious going forward then, not that it has to be Russian, because you do have that foot in early music and you've done contemporary music, but do you see this as maybe something where Clarion can sort of stake their claim as a choir that sort of maybe does do discoveries of pieces that kind of need a champion type of thing? I mean, that
yeah.
might be a nice niche
Absolutely.
Area for Clarion to step into.
Yeah.
For bringing it back to what originally Newell Jenkins had going, right?
Yeah.
Doing pieces here in New York that nobody really
absolutely
ever.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think that's a great idea. And I have been thinking about what we should do next. And I keep thinking about that first program that we did do down at Trinity. It was a Russian Christmas program. And that was full of all kinds of music that you just never hear.
Mm.
And I remember Vlad Morrison and I talked through that program. It was very hard to put together. I find programs where it's a hodgepodge of different composers, and that those are sometimes the hardest programs to construct, because you want to make sure that it has peaks in the right places, and that it's the right length, and every piece relates to each other well. When you're doing a big piece, you don't have to worry about that. You trust the composer that they've done that work.
Right.
But when, in this case, it's the conductor that has to put it together. But I really enjoyed that program, and I thought that maybe the world needs another. There are a few good Russian Christmas CDs, but the stuff that we did was very different from any of those CDs. And so I was thinking that could be a good idea. But then other major works like the Gretchaninoff setting, that's similar text to Steinberg. And then Gretchaninoff has also a very beautiful all-night vigil.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been thinking a lot about those pieces too.
Well, it's about Naxos is they usually let you ride the wave for a while, you know?
I mean, not only is our first recording with them, but this is my first recording with Clarion. It's our first recording since Newell Jenkins' days, so I'm excited about it, and definitely we're grateful to Naxos that they took an interest in this. They've been a really good partner.
Yeah, well, I wish you success going forward, and hope to hear more, you know, of all kinds of stuff. Who knows? I'll leave it up to you to find it. Who would have thought this? I close my cadence interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. First is a hypothetical, which simply says, if you could chat like we've been doing with someone from the past, so we never had a chance to pick their brain, what's the first name pops in your head? Don't think about it too long.
Well, it's always Mozart for me.
Is it Mozart?
Yeah. Sometimes people ask me, particularly people who are not completely enveloped in the classical world as I am, what do you listen to relax? You know, and they're expecting me to say rock and roll or something like that. And my answer is Mozart. He's the one composer that I can listen to and do other things. For me, it's just the apex. I just find that puts the chaos of my mind in order.
Yeah.
The music, it's just so balanced, so beautiful, so symmetrical, so tasteful. Yeah. So I'd almost be reluctant to want to meet someone like that, because I don't want to, you know, I know them only by their music, and I wouldn't want to let the personality,
get in the way.
But, certainly, this is, for me, you know, the greatest of the greats.
Yeah, being someone caught up with the voice, who better, you know, to not write for voice.
Yeah.
You know, caught up as far as Mozart letting you get away that way, that's my final question. It's a non-musical question I ask everybody in Cadenza, you know, who's very busy doing music. When you have to get away from music, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but can pull yourself away from it, what do you do there?
Well, I love languages, but I also think that's connected with music. But I really do find languages a great enjoyment, and I'm trying to brush up on my Russian before we go again. It's been several years since I've been back, so, and I've been really enjoying that this summer. But something not connected to music at all is I do love watching sports. I find that it's so different from what I do, you know, certain sports. I loved watching the Olympics. I just thought it was beautiful to watch what these people can do. And I'm also inspired by the training that goes in to that kind of competition. My favorite sport of all is tennis. I think it's just the most beautiful sport. I think it's elegant to watch, and I'm really a fanatic and try to go to tournaments as much as I can and watch it live. I didn't go to the Open this year because the last couple of years I've really overspent and gone to Wimbledon. But so I think I need to save again. But I do love the Open. I used to go with my father almost every year growing up, and the Open's changed a lot. It's bigger now. I kind of preferred it when it was a smaller, more intimate stadium.
It's
now they've even gotten rid of the old stadium and all those memories, so I'm a little bit mad at the U.S. Open, but I'm sure I'll forgive them soon, and I'll go again.
For that grass court. Stephen Fox, thanks for taking some time.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Stephen Fox, Artistic Director of the Clarion Society of New York. The orchestra and chorus give a full season of events, and you can find them listed at the Society's website, clarionsociety.org. They are at this moment in Moscow performing the work you've heard throughout this program, and their recording of Maximilian Steinberg's Passion Week is available on the Naxos label at naxos.com. I'll close with the final movement from this choral masterpiece, Let All Mortal Flesh Keep Silence. Once again, the Clarion Choir, led by their artistic director and my guest today, Stephen Fox, And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting in an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.